Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 683, interview number 3 with Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald. This program is being recorded on August 2nd of the year 2009. And once again, it is my privilege and pleasure to bring back to our airwaves Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould, the authors of the consummately important recent book, Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, published in softcover by City Lights Books. Elizabeth and Paul, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Well, thank you, Dave, for having us.
Thanks, Dave.
Continuing with the perhaps heavy-handed metaphor that I've used in the past about your book, describing it as a literary cluster bomb, not a literary bombshell or blockbuster, but a literary cluster bomb, I'd like to kick off this portion of our hours-long discussion about the book by reading a very, very stunning quote. And I want to stress for the listeners that, in a sense, this is kind of like when they sit in Starbucks and they bring around a little piece of a fresh banana frappuccino for you to taste. So this will give you a little sampling of the actual flavors between the covers, so to speak. And I'd like to use this as a jumping off point. On pages 294 and 295, you write about the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, a fellow named Craig Murray. And here's his description of, I guess one could say, the Afghani political and commercial landscape. And it's really quite stunning, and I'd like to sort of use this as a yardstick. And then over the course of the next hour, I'd like to explore how did we get to this point from where we started. And obviously, some review of what we've talked about in the past and some review of what went before this, obviously, will be mandated. On page 294, you write, a July 2007 article in the Daily Mail by Britain's former ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, explained how the West's short-sighted favoritism for Northern Alliance warlords acts against the war's stated objective of rooting out terror, instead turning Afghanistan from a mere grower of opium into the biggest heroin exporter in the world. Quote, it, Afghanistan, has succeeded in what our international aid efforts urge every developing country to do. Afghanistan has gone into manufacturing and value-added operations. It now exports not opium, but heroin. Opium is converted into heroin on an industrial scale, not in kitchens, but in factories. Millions of the gallons of the chemicals needed for this process are shipped into Afghanistan by tanker. The tankers and bulk opium lorries on the way to factories share roads improved by American aid with NATO troops, unquote. How could this have happened on this scale, Murray asked. The answer is simple. The four largest players in the heroin business are all senior members of the Afghan government. The government that our soldiers are fighting and dying to protect, unquote. Murray's testimony might seem like a contradiction given Britain and America's much publicized efforts to destroy Afghanistan's opium crop, but a careful look at the operation reveals that the program targets largely Pashtun farmers in the south near Kandahar, stoking the flames of Pashtun anger, while inadvertently protecting northern warlords like General Rashid Dostum, as head of the Afghan armed forces, operates around the interdiction without interference. Murray writes, Dostum is an Uzbek, and heroin passes over the friendship bridge from Afghanistan to Uzbekistan, where it is taken over by President Islam Karimov's people. It is then shipped up the railway line in bales of cotton to St. Petersburg and Riga. The heroin jeeps run from General Dostum to President Karimov. The UK, United States, and Germany have all invested large sums in donating the most sophisticated detection and screening equipment to the Uzbek Customs Center at Termez to stop the heroin from coming through. But the convoys of jeeps running between Dostum and Karimov are simply waved around the side of the facility, unquote. That is not exactly, I think, what most of the people who designed this particular operation had in mind. So, again, sort of as the theme of the program and as the vehicle for expose, how did we get to this appalling state of affairs from where we were?
Well, you know, the issue, Dave, is that the situation today is much further along than anyone realizes. And it was established, of course, during the Secret War, beginning in the 1970s, 1973, when the Marxists took over in 1978 in Afghanistan, the secret war intensified, and that just kind of that provided a kind of carte blanche. And a lot of the international groups, I mean, the French were very much involved in this, the French intelligence service, and Alexandre Desmaranges, I believe we spoke about this in the last program a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But the French were known to support their covert operations in Indochina with back in the 1950s, in the late in the 40s and the 1950s, with the opium trade. That was very much an aspect of that, and it was very well known amongst the intelligence community and outside the intelligence community. But that sort of thing really had been, the United States really wasn't implicated at that point. The United States is the latecomer to this process, and certainly the darker side of this process. And so as the United States grew in importance in these areas, in Southeast Asia and South Central Asia, in these prime opium growing areas in the 1950s and 60s, the United States began to develop ways in which, it involved itself in this. And at first, there were some people who were involved directly with the agency. And as a result of that, it became an embarrassment. You remember the church hearings back in the 1970s where all these dirty things that were going on were attributed to, you know, CIA covert actions. So what happened at the time was a lot of these things began to become privatized. And the Afghan War was a perfect example of the mating of a lot of these different interests in the Middle East and in Europe and in the United States to try to finance this covert war through Pakistan's ISI and the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, the BCCI, which was established by a Pakistani businessman. And so I'll read you from a book called The Outlaw Bank, just to give you an idea of, this was a book that was written a few years ago by Jonathan Beattie and S.C. Gwynn. We quoted in the book, thus the undertaking in Pakistan was planned as a hands-off operation for the CIA. Day-by-day contact with the Mujahideen would be left to the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence Agency. The United States could then deny any involvement. The CIA could supply the weapons and the money, weapons purchased from the third world countries, so they would not appear to have come from America, an untraceable cash money. Arrangements were also struck with China and Saudi Arabia. China agreed to sell the Mujahideen arms, and Saudi Arabia was to match U.S. financial contributions and send the funds through clandestine channels to the CIA, to the ISI, not the CIA. So this is the way it was in set up originally. It was off the books. Now, if you ask people today at the CIA what was going on, they said, well, of course, we had no direct involvement with it, but we did know there was a drug problem. Milt Bearden, who ran the CIA operation in the 1980s from Pakistan, 1984 on, has admitted on camera that they were well aware that the drugs were going on. He said, but it wasn't really their mission to deal with that. I mean, that's their way of dealing with it. Jack Blum, who was the special counsel to the Kerry Committee investigating the narcotics in 1987, stated at one point that 12 metric tons were seized off the Makhroom coast of Pakistan in 1987-1988. That's the world supply for a year. Okay, now that was 22 years ago. They were putting out, this particular secret war was putting out that kind of amount of drugs. And what we're doing is, I mean, I just picked up the newspaper the other day here in Boston, and they've got two articles that were not related but in the same newspaper. One was about the pure heroin that is coming into the city of Boston at this point. It's so pure that it can be snorted. It doesn't have to be injected. And the other thing was about the Kalashnikovs. Every time gangs are busted in Boston now, the police are picking up scores of rounds, thousands of rounds of ammunition and Kalashnikovs, which have been imported, it said, from China and from Eastern Europe. So, you know, the war has come home, and it's a lot further along than anyone realizes.
Elizabeth, some of the things that we talked about last time might be worth, I think, bringing up in terms of approaching how we got to that state of affairs where basically the Afghan government and four senior officials of that government are acting as executives in industrial-style heroin production. Between the Soviet withdrawal and the events of September 11th and the U.S., invasion into Afghanistan. You talked about the fossil fuels industry and various corporate interests that were sort of dining out on the United States. Why don't we recoup a little bit of that and then discuss Pakistan and the events of September 11th and how some of this actually led or overlaps those specific events, which, of course, triggered the U.S. invasion.
Well, I think that we really have to look at the entire events in Afghanistan really in light of a historical perspective. I mean, when you really do look at the way in which the drug trade really has been shown to wind itself through every one of these eras, that epics, that we are really looking at a process that really to end up with an Afghan government that basically is facilitating the largest expansion of drug trade in Afghanistan really should not be a surprise. That there was no way that anyone was going to be allowed to take the political power for Afghanistan. Remember back in 2001 when the Bonn conference took place, Hamid Karzai was really handpicked by the United States. And that, in fact, the warlords, like Dostum, were basically being invited right into the government. And that, so all the preconditions that really needed to be set up to guarantee that Karzai's government was going to facilitate this enhancement of the drug trade was inevitable. So this is the one of the issues that concerns me about the way in which Karzai's government, which really, they talk about, a puppet. I mean, there is no way that the Karzai government could have ended up in any other situation when it came to the drug relationship. So this is part of the reason that we have to begin to look at these deep roots and understand that the kind of play. Now, when you do bring in Pakistan and you do bring in the agenda that Pakistan also had, I thought that this might be a quote that might help to establish how long ago when we went out of our way to basically give President Zia the full power to determine who was going to get all the financing that was coming in through weapons and training and through Saudi Arabia, through the United States into Pakistan. This would have been back, in the 1980s. This was Selig Harrison, who's actually, he was he was a Washington Post correspondent. He was also one of the preeminent South Asia experts. And he's been on this issue, certainly in the Pakistan issue and the Afghan issue going way back, and he's spoken with many of the key players. And one of the people he interviewed was General Zia. And this is a quote that Selig Harrison made about his conversation. "General Zia spoke to me about expanding Pakistan's sphere of influence to control Afghanistan, then Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, and then Iran and Turkey," Harrison said. "The design continues," he said. "General Mohammad Aziz, who was involved in that Zia plan, has been elevated now to a key position by Chief Executive General Pervez Musharraf." So you see the handover that we're talking about in terms of the pan-Islamist movement, in terms of the deeper agendas that the United States through Zia was really signing on to. And again, the drugs really becomes the financial facilitator of this process. So we really have to begin to look at, the very tragic reality that foreign policy really is not what the front page of the news is telling us at all, that it really has more to do with these kinds of movements which are using, obviously, the cover of things like, the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. It was the greatest threat to, peace since World War II, and we have to do something about it. What that inaugurated was a whole host of activities that really were inevitably going to be financed by the drug trade. And when you bring that up to 2001 and you look at the individuals that the United States really forced on the new Afghan government, the warlords like Dostum, who were it was a fait accompli. That part of what was going to be activated in that kind of configuration was the drug trade. And now we're looking at, of course, the fact that the Taliban And again, when we have to remember the Taliban and its origins going back to Pakistani intelligence, with the idea of creating a Pakistani-friendly government in Afghanistan, is one of the major beneficiaries of the drug trade. So you're beginning, I think we're beginning to see that these are inevitable tie-ins.
I mean, as Liz mentioned, during the rule of Zia-ul-Haq in the 1980s, when he agreed to this arrangement with the U.S. and the CIA, he set up Governor Fazal Haq of the Northwest Frontier Province to run this drug operation, and they created a trucking company known as Logistics Cell to move the arms in and the drugs out. And a lot of this was going on during that time period, and it was reported in other media around the world. It was reported in Britain, it was reported in Canada, but we never got any of this story. In fact, at one point, we tried to, we gave an event in the fall of 1981 in Boston at a local hotel here, which was attended by a number of local and national media and international media. And the former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, who was then at the Tufts Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, he was the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. This was after our first trip, and we were presenting some of a look of in terms of what was actually going on inside Afghanistan. He stood up and said, "Who gave you permission to say this? Who gave you permission to do this?" And I told him, I said, I didn't realize as an American citizen I needed permission to do that sort of thing. There's no prohibition of going to Afghanistan. And he said, "Well, you're treading very closely to the line of a Soviet propagandist." So, I mean, this was the way, and there was a chill in the room at that point. Now, this was a man who had been on McNeil Lira two or three days after the Soviets invaded Afghanistan with Richard Pipes, who had been the leader of Team B. The two of them had sat there and they'd said, "Oh, the Soviets are invading Afghanistan because they're getting ready to conquer Europe and the Persian Gulf." Okay, this was the official line. And what we were doing from the very beginning was trying to crack that official line. And boy, they were putting out the word very, very clearly that if you were going to cross that line and start saying what was really going on in Afghanistan, we're going to start calling you names. And so, you know, so that was the chill that was put on the American media. And so as a result of that, I think a lot of what happened in the 1980s and why the story never got out about the drugs, about our relationship with Pakistan, about Pakistan, the development of Pakistan's nuclear weapons, about the support of terrorism in that part of the world. I mean, we're basically doing today what the Soviets were trying to do in 1979 and 1980, was to roll back terrorism in South Central Asia. And so none of that story ever got across to the American public. So it's very difficult today for our leaders, especially Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was instrumental in creating this particular paradigm in 1978 and 1979 at the National Security Council, as American policy, which would be followed by the Reagan administration and expanded upon by the Reagan administration. It's very difficult for them to explain to the United States public, as you said, how did we get in this? What are we doing there? What is happening? The situation, of course, was so far off the rails to begin with that now what's happened is it's taken on a life of its own, and the United States and I don't believe any of the major powers at this point really have a complete control over what's going
to
happen.
Elizabeth, I'd like to linger just a moment on the passage that you read, quoting Selig Harrison. I wonder if I could prevail on you to reread just the few sentences in which the scope of projected Pakistani power into Asia is described, specifically the areas in which they're looking to project their direct influence.
The sphere of influence to control Afghanistan, then Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, and then Iran and Turkey.
It's quite something. I can't imagine people in Berkeley demonstrating against Pakistani imperialism, yet when one contemplates that projected strategy, it is almost like a mirror image of what Team B was presenting as the Soviet goal, in which, to an extent, Paul just rearticulated, namely the drive to the Persian Gulf with the distorted intelligence and so forth. One of the many strong points of your book is that it brings out, I think, things that even the average well-informed American simply is not, of which they are not cognizant. And again, the extent to which The way policy is unfolding there is, in certain respects, a manifestation of Pakistani imperial designs.
I think you really have to put it, though, in perspective. I mean, you know, remember, Zia ended up assassinated. So whatever his design was, his role ended rather abruptly. So he served a purpose, and then he was gone. Maybe his fate was sealed when he was so bold to boast about these things publicly. So I think that, you know, when you look at these mid-level players, like Saddam Hussein and Noriega and, you know, Zia, I think you have to realize that, you know, that sometimes they get a little too, their ego takes over. But that's what's so interesting about Zbigniew Brzezinski, because here is a man who is actually publicly boasted about the fact that he drew the Soviets into Afghanistan with the intent of holding them there. And he's never paid a political price for that at all. So it is kind of interesting to see how some of them seem to, you know, vanish.
I mean, I would say, you know, you certainly can't look at the situation as a black and white situation. You can't look at it monolithically.
Sure.
I think that, and that's the secret, and that's what we're trying to do with our book. It's almost, our book is like an instruction manual for, you know, for how to look at these things with a different point of view, maybe pull back a little bit further. I mean, in the 1980s, let's say that the Mujahideen and the Muslim extremists were being used as the tool of French intelligence, British intelligence, and American intelligence in order to undermine the control of the Soviet Union in that part of the world. So let's say at that point in time, in the 1980s, the relationship was 80-20. It was 80%, you know, we gave them the satellite photos, we gave them the weapons, we arranged the weapons deals, we provided the technology, we gave them the Stinger missiles, we provided them with the, you know, with the Hercules airlifters to lift those Kalashnikovs out of Egypt and bring them to Peshawar to make it look as if they were Russians, who, you know, they were Afghan soldiers who had defected, you know, that sort of thing, okay? So let's say it was any 80-20. Well, now, because of the world situation, because of the weakness of the Western financial situation, both in Europe and the United States, because of the economic crisis, and the fact that, you know, the United States pays paper money for real oil, and the Saudis and those people in the Middle East who sit on top of that stuff, and those people in South Central Asia and the Caspian Basin who sit on that stuff, they really have real commodities, which we're trying to still convince, our governments are still trying to convince them to take paper money for. Let's say the influence now isn't 80-20 any longer. Maybe the influence is 55-65%, okay? We're still maybe over the 50% mark in terms of our influence on these people, but as the technology changes and technologies become more available, the computer technology and the development of industries in China and India and around the world, we don't have the weight we had even 30 years ago.
I also think we really need to keep in mind the historical underpinnings of the kind of movements that originally brought the British Empire to the region was really eventually expressed by Alfred Mackinder, you know, as the control of this region really was considered to be key, and keeping the Russian Empire at bay was key. And then we go into the 20th century and we see literally a replay of the same dynamics that really drove the British Empire to its relationship with Afghanistan. But what's so interesting is the fact that the British Empire was never able to really subjugate Afghanistan, even though it left it in a condition that eventually did produce a crisis within the country. It's still a very different crisis than if Afghanistan had actually been colonized by the British Empire. So what we're looking at today really is this sort of final act of this play of this idea that Mackinder had stirred and that is still being used. Here we are at the end of, you know, we're at the beginning of the 21st century, and we're now still living with an idea about how to control the world by controlling Eurasia. And certainly Zbigniew Brzezinski is a big advocate of that idea and has gone, you know, into obviously many decades of political influence to try to guarantee that control, and especially to keep the Russians out of having any influence on the region. So, and if you look at the oil interests and other natural resource interests that are all at play there, and then the drugs become simply a part of the economy. This is really what the drugs have become.
Right. And there's another aspect to this too, and that is, you know, the U.S. support here for what used to be called the War on Terror, I mean, what's interesting is that the Pakistanis have requested that they be given the same kind of high-tech tools the United States has been using, the Predator drones and the satellite information to, so that they can target their own terrorists. Well, this is where it gets very dicey for the United States, because Pakistan was established, as a kind of military base after World War II. Jinnah made, who was the president of the first president and the founding father of Pakistan, he made a deal with the British that he would allow military presence of Western military bases in Pakistan following the war. And so as a beginning, the Punjabi military were pretty much the people who ran Pakistan, who were the ruling elite in Pakistan. And they've been the ones who've been suppressing all these other not necessarily minority, but other ethnic groups within the state of Pakistan. This happened, of course, with the issue over Bangladesh. It was another nationality. They wanted to pull away from this Punjabi-controlled state. And so this has also been going on with this so-called war on terror. The Punjabi military in Pakistan, which runs the country, has been targeting Baluch nationalists and Pashtun nationalists. And it has suddenly, over a period of 7 or 8 years, transformed from a war on so-called terror to a war on Baluch and Pashtun nationalists. And this is becoming more and more evident. And this is a self-defeating process for the United States, because to Pashtun and Baluchi nationalists, the United States is now seen as supporting a Punjabi military.
And then when you can add the Taliban confusion to that, you end up really with a very dangerous situation, especially for Afghanistan.
So the U.S. policy has enabled the Taliban to pose as the champion of both Islam and of Pashtun nationalism. And this is completely self-defeating for the United States. Add to the fact that based on present counterterrorism doctrine, counterinsurgency doctrine, you'd have to have somewhere between 400,000 to 500,000 troops inside that area in order to pacify that population. And that's just not going to happen. The money isn't there to do that. The Europeans don't have those kind of numbers of troops, and neither do the United States.
In fact, we actually have heard from a number of Afghans that if the United States actually simply stopped financing Pakistan, then a lot of the problems in the region would be resolved in a regional way. That the problem is this hyper-military advantage that Pakistan has been given by the United States to basically dominate the way in which the region is handled. And Pakistan really has had an obsession, really, about its eventual war with India, and everything has been driven through that window.
So you see, during the Cold War, this is exactly what Pakistan would do. Whenever with these nationalist groups, these Pashtun nationalist groups, or Sindhi nationalist groups, or Baluchi nationalist groups, would start an uprising, Pakistan would get on the telephone, call Washington, and blame it on the communists. They'd blame it on the Soviet Union. Now what's happening is they can't blame it on the Soviet Union any longer, so they say, well, that's an Al-Qaeda guy who's doing that down there. So you give us the satellite pictures and the drones, and we'll go down there, we'll kill those guys, okay? We don't know, and the fact is that probably in many cases, the United States is aligning itself with an extermination campaign that is being projected by the Punjabi military on its enemies.
But it does really fit the whole idea of the Mackinder idea that clearly that this
Elizabeth,
has to be controlled.
Elizabeth, I'm just going to jump in here. We are almost out of time on this side. I'd like to have you promote your website and where people can obtain the book, and let's continue with the discussion of the tribes and Pakistani intent towards same and how that's playing out. Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. Your website?
InvisibleHistory.com. You can go to CityLights.com. You can get it there, too. We have it right on the website. There's a link right to City Lights.
Very good. And we have been speaking with Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, the authors of the consummately important recent book, Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, soft cover edition City Lights Books. We'll be talking more with Paul and Elizabeth in Side 2. But this concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 683, interview number 3 with Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould. This program is being recorded on August 2nd of the year 2009. My name is Dave Emery. For Paul and Elizabeth, thanks for listening.